Weapons of all nature have occupied us these many off-season months, and leading them are our negotiations for reducing nuclear arms and working with the Russians to do so. We're also very aware of the efforts to establish an understanding with the Iranians, and then there's always the wild card of North Korea. Ambassador Pfeiffer will also briefly remind us of the agreements regarding chemical and biological weapons. As director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative, Ambassador Pfeiffer's career has focused on nuclear arms reduction. However, he has also served as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, has held a long career in the State Department, and served as Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. Ambassador Pfeiffer is a graduate of Stanford University, and while traveling last week to Germany, I asked him just for something simple. I said, you know, could you go and talk to Chancellor Merkel for us? Just put in a good word for the United States. But being the perfect diplomat that he is, he said, you know, we got to wait a little while longer. It's my pleasure to introduce Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer.
Well, first of all, let me thank both Judy and Mimi for the very kind introduction. Let me also thank you for welcoming my wife, Marilyn, here, although when I look around the audience, I think I know who my toughest critic tonight's going to be. I'm delighted that the Council on World Affairs invited me to come here and talk to you, and I'm going to focus on nuclear weapons and nuclear arms control. Now, these are issues that, in the Cold War, really dominated the news, and today you don't read so much about them, and that's a good thing. I mean, it's good that nuclear weapons are no longer such a big part of the relationship between Washington and Moscow. But in the next 30 to 35 minutes, what I hope to be able to do is show you how nuclear arms control can be useful from the perspective of the United States in terms of making us all safer and more secure. So I'll break my talk down into four pieces. First of all, I'll begin with a review of the history of arms control regarding weapons of mass destruction. That's chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. And there's really a very rich history there, a lot that's been done over the last 50 years. Then I'll talk about some of the reasons why arms control makes sense, how it can advance our American interests. Third, I'll talk about some of the opportunities that are out there to do things in the next several years that would leave us in a safer and more secure position. And then finally, I'll address some of the challenges that might slow us down in terms of realizing those opportunities. So let me start with a review, and I'll start with chemical weapons, simply because those have been in the news in the last couple of months due to the use of chemical weapons in Syria in August. And first, let me put up a map. This shows you in green all of the states that adhere to the Chemical Weapons Convention. And that's a pretty good treaty in the sense of almost universal participation. Only four countries do not participate. 2 months ago, if I'd showed this, there would have been one more red blotch, Syria, but in the last 2 months, Syria has agreed to join the Chemical Weapons Convention, and it was announced by international experts earlier this week that they have successfully destroyed the production facilities that Syria used to produce its chemical weapons. You still have to destroy Syria's actual stocks, but progress is being made. This agreement entered into force in 1997, and at that time, there were about 70,000 tons of chemical weapons, mainly in the American and Russian arsenals. As of last year, about 80% of those stockpiles had been destroyed. The bulk still remains mainly in the United States and Russia, but each of those countries has timelines now for the elimination of the remaining stocks. So this was, I think, a fairly successful agreement. The Biological Weapons Convention actually was done couple of decades earlier, back in the 1970s. And it bans the production, the acquisition, the stockpiling of biologic weapons. But in some ways, it was a fairly easy arms control agreement to do. And that is because most of the militaries in the world concluded biological weapons really were not that useful. You could not use them to affect the outcome on a particular battlefield. And if you were to use them against an adversary's population, the world has now become so interconnected and globalized that there's no guarantee it wouldn't come back and hit your population. So even though this convention has very little in terms of verification, most countries signed up on it because they regarded that biologic weapons really didn't make much sense. The third area of weapons of mass destruction is nuclear arms control treaties. And I won't test you at the end of this discussion all these acronyms. I apologize, but arms control tends to use lots of acronyms. But I wanted to put this up just to show that a lot has gone on in arms control in the nuclear area in the last 5 decades. The column on the left, those are U.S.-Soviet or U.S.-Russian agreements, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty. And they have capped and then reduced significantly, and I'll come to that in a moment, U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons levels. The treaties in yellow actually were signed, but for various reasons did not enter into force. But still, there's been progress. On the right-hand side there, you have the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which limited ballistic missile defenses in the early 1970s, the idea being that that could then facilitate agreement on reducing strategic arms. And then finally, on the lower right, you have the Test Ban Treaty, starting with the Limited Test Ban Treaty in 1963, which basically required that any nuclear testing had to be underground. Now, we call that an arms control agreement. It was really more of an environmental agreement, because what we found was with above-ground testing in the 1950s, we were putting a lot of radioactive materials into the atmosphere, problems such as strontium-90 turning up in milk. And so the decision was taken really to drive nuclear testing underground. From the point of view of the guys who actually did the tests, they actually were very happy with that because they found testing underground was much more stable. You didn't have to worry about things like weather and such. But what this chart shows is there's actually been quite a bit done in nuclear arms control. And here's a picture of the effect. This chart shows the U.S. nuclear stockpile from 1945 up until 2012. And as a result of several things, arms control, unilateral decisions, and I think the fact that the American military has come to a conclusion that nuclear weapons really don't have a lot of military utility, you see a significant decline. In the early 1960s, the U.S. stockpile peaked at more than 33,000 total weapons, a pretty astonishing number. Today, it's down about 4,500 weapons. And then that the graph in red there, those are deployed strategic warheads. And those are the weapons that arms controllers tend to worry about the most, because most of those sit on intercontinental ballistic missiles or submarine-launched ballistic missiles and could be launched in a matter of minutes. An ICBM out in Montana, if it ever got a valid launch order, it could be flying in about 2 minutes. The weapons in blue are usually separated from the delivery systems. They're in storage, and it would take days, sometimes weeks, to prepare them for delivery. So they tend to get a second level of concern. But even on deployed strategic warheads, you know, there's been significant progress, particularly since the end of the Cold War in the 1980s, in bringing those numbers down. And we're going to make more progress. In April of 2010, President Obama and then Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, or New START. And that treaty, which is about 500 pages long, it's got all sorts of detailed annexes on verification and counting rules and agreed definitions, but it has three basic limits, and I put the two most important limits up here. One is each side in 2018, which is when the limits take full effect, can have no more than 700 deployed missiles and bombers. And again, the concept of a deployed missile would be a missile in a missile silo or in a missile tube on a submarine, a missile that could be launched very quickly. We don't care that much about missiles in storage because it takes a long time to prepare them for use. And then what I regard as the more important limit is each side will be limited to no more than 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. Now here, I don't want to get too arms control wonky, but I have to introduce to you something I call arms control math, which is not the math that you learned in school. In arms control, 1 does not always equal 1, and 1,550 does not always equal 1,550. And that's because of the counting rules. What that 1,550 does is it limits warheads on strategic ballistic missiles. So each one of those warheads counts as exactly 1 in that 1,550 count. But when the negotiators were looking about bombers, they had a problem, because for the last 20 years, neither the American Air Force nor the Russian Air Force keeps any weapons on their bombers. Those weapons are at storage bunkers at the air bases. And it seemed a little bit odd to count a bomber as 0 weapons, so they agreed that each bomber would count as 1. Now, that significantly understates what modern bombers can carry. But the logic here actually goes back about 40 years, and that is traditionally arms control worries less about bombers than ballistic missiles, and it all has to do with flight times. A submarine-launched ballistic missile can reach its target in about 15 minutes. An intercontinental ballistic missile may take 25 to 30 minutes. Bombers are going to take 8 to 10 hours. And in many scenarios, by the time the bomber gets there, the war is pretty much over. So there's always been that looser treatment for bombers, and that's why 1550 actually probably equals maybe more like about 1800 on each side. So that's where we are now. We're implementing the New START Treaty. Those limits take full effect in February of 2018. And let me now transition and begin to make some arguments about why arms control still makes sense and why we ought to do more. First, 1550 is certainly progress. It's much less than the 8,000 to 9,000 deployed strategic weapons that the United States and the Soviet Union each had in the 1980s. But I still ask the question, we're two decades after the end of the Cold War, 20 years after the end of the Soviet Union, does 1550 still make sense today? And as a general proposition, I would argue that if we can bring that number down, it means less Russian nuclear weapons pointed at the United States, and I think that's a good thing. And arms control can be a vehicle to achieve that. A second reason is that when you look at the Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, or New START, it only covers about 40% of the American and Russian nuclear arsenals. Each of those arsenals now about a total of 4,500 weapons. Again, deployed strategic weapons are constrained by New START, but then you have two categories which are not. First of all, non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapons. These tend to be shorter-range weapons, very much of concern to American allies. And that's an area where the Russians have a significant advantage, at least 4-1. Some estimates say the Russians may be as much as 6 or 8-1 over the United States. And that bothers our allies. And it's hard to see how we're going to reduce that advantage by a mechanism other than arms control. Then there's one other category, reserve strategic weapons. These are weapons for intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, but they're not actually on the missiles. They're sitting somewhere in storage. And that's an area of American advantage. And if we get clever, maybe we can actually trade those two advantages off one against the other to reduce the Russian tactical advantage. But the point here is that we're not going to get at those numbers and begin to bring them down, I think, without a good measure of arms control. Another advantage of arms control is transparency. It helps us know more about the Russians and their strategic forces. Under the New START Treaty, every 6 months, the United States and Russia exchange a huge amount of data, including the location of every deployed ballistic missile in their force. Now, they publicize some top-line numbers, including the numbers I put up here. Remember, the United States is still above the limits because those limits don't fully kick in for another 4 years. But my point here on transparency is when you look at deployed strategic missiles and bombers, these things are big. Intercontinental ballistic missile probably weighs 30 tons. It's 45 to 60 feet long. We know where the ICBM silos are. So with our national technical means of verification, which is a euphemism for things like spy satellites, we have a pretty good idea how many missiles and bombers the Russians have and submarines. That's not hard. But that bottom number, deployed warheads, that's harder. We don't yet have a satellite that can look through a silo door, look through a nose cone, and count the number of warheads on a Russian SS-18 missile. And we get this information, though, from the Russians. 10 times a year, each side's allowed to do what's called a Type 1 inspection at a missile base or a submarine base. And an American inspection team that arrives at a Russian ICBM base is almost immediately given a list. And that list shows every deployed ICBM at that base and the number of warheads on each individual missile. And then the American team gets to, at its choice, choose one of those to go and inspect and confirm that the number is correct. Well, we get to bring that list home. We've now done almost 30 inspections of Russian facilities. So there's a huge amount of information that we have from the arms control treaties that we would not have received otherwise. And that means we can avoid worst-case assumptions and make smarter decisions about how we operate our own forces. Here's another reason for arms control, potential cost savings. The United States maintains a triad of bombers, land-based missiles, and missiles on submarines. And we're going to have to start making decisions about how we modernize, particularly the submarines and the bombers. The bottom right picture there is an Ohio-class ballistic missile submarine. The first one of those gets retired around 2029. And that means that the Navy wants to build a replacement submarine and starting construction around 2020 or 2021, which means we have to make, or the U.S. military has to make, design decisions in the next couple of years and start long-term procurement. It's estimated right now that the replacement submarine for the Ohio boat will run $6 to $7 billion each. That does not count the development costs. It does not count the cost of the torpedoes, and it does not count the cost of the missiles. Now, the Navy is working very hard to try to bring those prices down. But the history of Navy shipbuilding, and these are extremely complicated machines, the history is the prices go up. My argument is if the United States and Russia could negotiate another agreement to bring numbers down, in the 2020s, we could have to build fewer bombers, fewer submarines, fewer missiles, and that's going to mean budget savings at a time when the Defense Department's budget is under considerable pressure. The last reason I would argue for arms control is for our non-proliferation credentials. The United States and Russia, between them, control 90 to 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. Each country at about 4,500 weapons total. The third country is probably France at about 300 weapons. It's awfully difficult, I believe, for the United States to go to China and say, don't build up, or to go to Iran and say, don't build any nuclear weapons, if we're not actively working to reduce our numbers and the Russian numbers. Now, I'm a realist about this. I don't think another American-Russian arms control agreement is going to lead to a huge change of heart overnight in North Korea or Iran. But it will help us with third countries. And by increasing our diplomatic credibility, we're going to have more success with those countries in getting them to pressure the nuclear renegades. And as an example, in 2010, we signed the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty. Since 2010, we've had great success at persuading other countries to apply additional economic and financial sanctions on Iran, to the point now where there's a chance the Iranians may be prepared to talk about their nuclear program in a way that they haven't been prepared to talk about in the last 7 or 8 years. Now, I'll talk about one other point. President Obama in 2009 in Prague made a speech in which he set the long-term objective, the ultimate goal, as creating the conditions for a world without nuclear weapons. He also said that as long as there are nuclear weapons in the world, the United States has to have an effective nuclear deterrent. And I think that was a very important qualifier. But let me spend a couple minutes talking to you why I would think from an American point of view that a goal of a world without nuclear weapons makes sense as long as you could do it in a verifiable way that we can be confident nobody kept any of these. And I'll cite it by going back to what happened during the Cold War was nuclear deterrence was really at the base of the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And nuclear deterrence worked in the sense that it kept America and the Soviet Union from going to direct conflict with one another. When you had two countries that were opposed in military, psychological, political, ideological terms. And I think deterrence was a success. But I would attach a qualifier, and that is at several points, we got very, very lucky. And I'll give you two or three examples. The first example, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when the Soviets deployed medium-range missiles in Cuba that could target about the eastern two-thirds of the United States. At the end, President Kennedy made a decision to impose a naval blockade on Cuba while working out a solution with Khrushchev. When he made that decision, though, he overruled the advice from his military and civilian advisors, most of whom argued instead for airstrikes on Cuba, followed 3 days later by an invasion by the Marines and the Army. What President Kennedy and the Central Intelligence Agency and the Joint Chiefs of Staff did not know in 1962, what we only learned in the 1990s, was that the commander of Soviet forces on the island of Cuba had already been given by Moscow release authority for tactical nuclear weapons in the event of an American invasion. What would have happened had the American Marines landed on the northern side of Cuba and the commander there used 3 or 4 nuclear weapons against them? How would things have spun out of control? Second example where we got lucky, and I'll use an American case here, but there are also cases on the Soviet and the Russian side that parallel this. In 1979, at the North American Air Defense Headquarters, buried under Cheyenne Mountain near Colorado Springs, all of a sudden in the alert room, alerts go off and the screens on the computers are showing 500 Soviet intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine launched ballistic missiles inbound to the United States. Things happen. Immediately, NORAD convenes a threat assessment conference. But this was a time when the United States still maintained nuclear weapons onboard aircraft on strip alert, designed to take off in 10 minutes. Those crews are being scrambled with the bombers. They're spooling up engines, getting ready to taxi and take off. At other air bases, tankers that will refuel them are beginning to spool up. Alerts are being sent to submarines. Alerts are being sent to the ICBM bases. And after 8 minutes, somebody discovers, oh, wait, a mistake's been made, a training tape has been inserted into the wrong computer. So the sort of training tape that they saw was for 8 minutes taken as real world. Now, had that gone on a little bit longer, what would have happened if the Soviets all of a sudden started seeing large numbers of American nuclear bombers taking off, picking up radio traffic suggesting that our alert status was going up for ICBMs? How would they have reacted? A second time we got lucky. A third time we got lucky, and you have to bear in mind nuclear weapons are pretty complex pieces of equipment, but in 1961, an American B-52 bomber, and this was at a time in the 60s when we flew bombers with nuclear weapons on board. We kept them constantly airborne to avoid being destroyed in a surprise attack. This bomber refueled, a fire broke out in the B-52, and somewhere over North Carolina exploded. And in addition to the wreckage coming down, its two nuclear weapons came down. This is a picture of one of them. It's a Mark 39 hydrogen bomb with a yield of about 2 megatons. That's about 200 times the weapon that destroyed Hiroshima. The good news in this picture is that the parachutes deployed, and that slowed the bomb so that when it impacted, it didn't break into lots of pieces. The bad news in this picture is the parachute deployed, and that's because the deployment of the parachute is part of the bomb's arming sequence. And when technicians took a look at this, what they found is of the 6 steps to go from drop from airplane to detonation, the bomb had taken 5 of them. One more step and there would have been a very large explosion in the middle of North Carolina. Now, some good news. One is, as a matter of policy, the U.S. Air Force no longer flies nuclear weapons on board aircraft. Second, nuclear weapons today on the U.S. arsenal side, I believe, are much safer. There are additional security devices to make sure that they would not detonate accidentally. But I caution on 2 things. One is, these are still very complex pieces of equipment. And while I may be more confident in the safety and security of American weapons, when you look at a country like Pakistan, you know, there may be a question mark. So I think deterrence has worked, but we got lucky. And the question is, if we're going to continue to rely on deterrence, are we confident that our luck will always be good going out in the future, particularly when you have more countries with nuclear weapons than was the case in the past? The flip side of that is I look at a world, if we could achieve it, and again, I don't know if we could ever get there. I think it would be very, very hard, perhaps impossible, to get a nuclear-free world. But if you could get there, from the American perspective, you know, that's not a bad world. We have friendly neighbors in Canada and Mexico. We have the protection afforded by the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. And we have the world's most powerful conventional forces. Now, there would still be questions about how do you defend allies and such, but setting that world against a world where we continue to depend upon nuclear deterrence, which I think has risks, I think it's worth considering. So let me now turn to, in the near term, I mean, this is, again, if you're talking about zero, that's a long way out in the future. I think you get there by a series of steps, a step-by-step process. And let me talk about what some of those early steps might be. First would be the question of, could we reduce U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons further below the limits in the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty? In June, the president was in Berlin. He called for reducing the 1,550 limit in New START by a third, down to about 1,000. And he also called for dramatic reductions in tactical nuclear weapons. Now, he didn't describe how these would be bundled together or how these would be structured. But back in 2011, when I talked to people within the U.S. government, they were attracted to this idea, which I call the big treaty. Now, these numbers here are not U.S. government numbers. The numbers are numbers that Mike O'Hanlon and I came up with for our book. But the concept is what the U.S. government was thinking about 2.5 years ago. And the idea was it was time to move beyond limiting just deployed strategic weapons to limit all U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons, strategic, non-strategic, deployed, non-deployed, have a single limit, which Mike and I suggested 2,000 to 2,500, that would cover all weapons. And then within that one limit, you would have a sublimit of 1,000 deployed strategic warheads, because those 1,000 warheads, the strategic warheads that are deployed, are the ones of greatest concern. And then you take your 700 limit on missiles and bombers and perhaps bring it down to 500. Now, this would leave the United States and Russia, it would mean about a 50% reduction in their current arsenals, but it would still leave two nuclear superpowers significantly above the rest of the world at no more than 300 weapons apiece. And that aggregate limit, what it does is it basically forces the Russians to reduce their advantage in non-strategic weapons in return for which the American side would reduce its advantage in reserve strategic weapons. It affects a trade-off that you could not achieve otherwise. My sense is that the U.S. government now thinks less in terms of this big treaty, and it's a time matter. They're not sure that they could finish a treaty like this in the time that the Obama administration has remaining in office. So when I talk to people at the State Department now, they're talking more in sort of different approaches. One approach for deployed strategic weapons, and then deal with the reserve strategic weapons and the tactical weapons in a separate but parallel channel. But the point is that, you know, either whichever route we go, there is a possibility to significantly cut U.S.-Russian weapons, bring the levels down by, I'd argue, about 50%, but that would still leave us as nuclear superpowers a notch above everybody else. Now, that's one opportunity. Another opportunity goes to the question of testing. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was signed in 1996. It has to be ratified by about 40 countries before it can be brought into force. The United States Senate considered the treaty in 1999 and declined to ratify it. And the Senate had two questions which were actually very serious questions. They said, one, if we can't test in the United States, how do we remain confident that our nuclear weapons will be reliable? I think that's a perfectly good question. And the second question was, if we don't test, how are we confident that nobody else tests, that nobody cheats? Now, what happened then is we've had an unofficial moratorium in effect. The only country that's tested in the last decade has been North Korea. But there is an argument made that bringing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty into force, which American ratification would give it a big boost toward, it would actually then raise the political bar against testing. And I think today, if you go back and you look at the questions the Senate asked, in fact, you have much better answers. So for the last 15 years, the Department of Energy has run a program called the Stockpile Stewardship Program, where they use computer simulations, lots of tests short of an actual nuclear explosion, to monitor the reliability of nuclear weapons. And they'll take 8 or 10 weapons apart each year and then test different pieces. And as a result of this program, they've certified, and the head of Strategic Command has certified, that the weapons are reliable. And they're very confident that we could continue to do this without having to test. So I think that first answer, or the answer to the question the Senate first asked, there's a better answer. The answer now is that we can be confident the weapons are reliable without testing. The second question was, could you in fact detect cheating? And there have been improvements in American detection means. But in parallel, you've had this picture, which I just put up here, on comprehensive test ban treaty monitoring. This is a network. There are about 300 dots on that map of the world. And that's a network set up by the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization to monitor for nuclear tests around the world. It includes seismic stations to detect underground tests. It includes hydrophones in the ocean to detect an underwater test, which would generate noise that would travel thousands of miles. It has air sniffers to detect the radionuclides that a test would produce. The system's now about 85% of the 300-plus stations are operating, and with this system, they have confidence that they could detect a test anywhere in the world of 1 kiloton. And moreover, in areas of particular interest, North Korea, the Russian test sites, the Chinese test sites, where the geology is right, they're confident that they could detect a test down to about 0.1 to 0.2 kilotons. So we're now at the point where I think we can tell the Senate we could detect a militarily significant test anywhere in the world. I toss out two other reasons why I think it makes sense to go forward with ratification of the Test Ban Treaty. And one is political, and it's Nevada. You may have read how Nevada fought tooth and nail against storage of nuclear waste at the old test site about 60 miles north of Las Vegas. Does anybody think, in political terms, it would be possible to resume nuclear testing in Nevada? So by not ratifying the treaty, we may be protecting the right for the United States to resume testing, but it's a right that I would argue the United States would never exercise. The other reason comes back to this chart, which is that the total number of nuclear explosions conducted since 1945, the United States has conducted more than the rest of the world combined. And what that means is we've learned a lot more about nuclear explosions, nuclear weapons, and the effects than everybody else. And my hardcore realist argument for the Test Ban Treaty is, why would we not want to freeze everybody else in a situation where they know less about nuclear weapons than we do? So I think there's an opportunity there to move forward. It's complicated by the fact that the dynamic now, as you've all seen from the newspapers, between the White House and the Senate is not particularly a positive one. But if you could find a way, ratification of this treaty, I think, would be in the American interest. A third opportunity is multilateralization. As I would argue that the United States and Russia, because we control 90 to 95% of the nuclear weapons of the world, we have the primary responsibility to lead on reductions. But the reductions process cannot remain forever just the United States and Russia. This shows the number of nuclear weapons all the way down to North Korea at the end there on the right. But at some point, we have to begin to broaden that process. And there may be an opportunity in the next several years. I would start by approaching the French, Chinese, and British and saying, look, we don't want to ask you to take reductions. We don't want to ask you to do a formal treaty. But would you be prepared, for example, to make a unilateral political commitment not to increase as long as the United States and Russia are coming down? Help create conditions in which it would be easier for America and Russia to reduce. And there may be some opportunities for the United States and Russia to work together on this question in the next couple of years. So those are the opportunities. Let me speak now briefly about the challenges. What might hinder our ability to realize these opportunities? The first, the biggest challenge is Vladimir Putin and the Russians. By everything we've seen publicly out of Moscow in the last year and a half, the Russians aren't much interested in reductions below the New START level. And what they do is they link reductions to missile defense questions and conventional forces, and they've got it tied up in a big knot. I tend to be optimistic. I think there are a couple reasons why the Russians might at some point want to return to the negotiating table. And I'll return to a couple of charts I showed earlier. This shows the New START treaty numbers as of September. And what you'll notice here is that in both cases, deployed missiles and bombers and deployed warheads, the Russians are already under the limits of New START. And because the Russians now have a lot of old missiles, old submarines in their inventory, those numbers are going to continue to go down for several years. So the question I would pose to Moscow is, do you really want to build back up to 1550? Or if we could come up with a lower limit on deployed strategic warheads, say 1,000, you can save that money, you can save resources and devote them to other requirements. And it's an argument that might have more resonance in Moscow at a time when their economy appears to be slowing. And some are even projecting that the Russian economy may stagnate in the next couple of years. So this is one possible incentive. Second incentive gets back to this chart I showed earlier about the reserve strategic warheads. And the United States and Russia are both implementing the New START treaty in different ways. The Russians take a missile out of service, but those missiles that remain in service have full warhead sets. So the SS-18 can carry 10 warheads. We believe all their SS-18s have 10 warheads on it. What the United States is doing is keeping more missiles, and we're taking warheads off of missiles so that most, if not all, of our missiles actually carry fewer warheads than they're capable of carrying. So the Trident submarine missile can carry 8 warheads. That's been tested, and that was, in fact, their usual load during the Cold War. But under New START, the plan is that each Trident missile carry only 4 to 5 warheads. So that's going to mean 3 to 4 empty spaces on each one of those missiles. And those reserve warheads are going to be in storage for another 10 or 15 years. We actually have a backlog in terms of dismantling weapons. And what this means is, were the treaty to break down or there to be a crisis, if the U.S. military had to, it could break the treaty limits and deploy probably an additional 1,000 warheads to its force. And for the foreseeable future, the Russians can't do that, and that bothers the Russian military. So negotiating away that advantage might give us some incentives and might give us some capital to get the Russians to address their tactical nuclear weapons advantage. So these are, I think, some strategic incentives the Russians may have. I try to be optimistic, but I have to confess, so far from Moscow, you're not seeing much interest in further nuclear reductions. A second challenge is verification. And when the New START Treaty was ratified at the end of 2010, it was ratified after the American intelligence community testified to the Senate, and they said, we have high confidence in our ability to monitor the limits, to detect cheating. And a large part of that was monitoring warhead limits. And warheads are relatively small, but a deployed warhead is on a ballistic missile, and we pretty much know where the ballistic missiles are. So that gave us high confidence that, in fact, we could monitor the treaty's deployed warhead limit. If you start talking about reserve weapons or tactical weapons, you're talking about weapons that are separate from delivery systems. And you're talking about going to places like this, storage bunkers. This is not necessarily an insoluble problem. but it's going to force both the American and Russian militaries to move way beyond their comfort zones in terms of accepting intrusive verification measures and letting the other guy go to places that normally you would not want to let the other side's military visit. Again, I think it's a soluble problem, but it's going to take time. The last problem, and I'll try not to get too political here, is the U.S. Senate. It's pretty clear that, as a general rule, Republicans are more skeptical of the value of arms control than Democrats. And I think there is a question in the minds of the Obama administration that were they to do another arms control treaty, could it receive approval by 2/3 of the Senate for ratification? And there's a fear that it could not. So the administration, I believe, is thinking about, are there ways other than a legally binding treaty to do an agreement that would not face the possibility that it might be rejected by the Senate? So those are some of the challenges. I'll just close with a couple of observations. I think nuclear reductions make sense. There's an opportunity there. We're going to have to wait, though, on the Russians, and it's uncertain at this point how they're prepared to proceed. On the test ban treaty, I think there's huge advantages for the United States, but I don't think that the current political climate between Congress and where the Senate and the White House is conducive. So that may be something that doesn't get realized as quickly as I would like. And so we may be at this point where the challenges are going to hold us back from realizing some of these opportunities. And I think that's unfortunate because these opportunities in each case, I would argue, would leave the United States in a safer and more secure situation. But because of the prospect of achieving those opportunities, I think we nevertheless ought to keep pushing. Thanks very much, and I'd be happy to take questions.
If the United States and Russia were to sit down practically and discuss decide how many nuclear weapons they would need as a deterrent that would destroy the economy and the society of any nation who would attack us, how many do you think we'd really need?
I think if the United States and Russia each went to what people describe as a minimal deterrent, probably a couple of hundred. It wouldn't take much more. Where it gets a little bit awkward, and I think it's hard, is the requirement for a larger number of weapons, I believe, is driven primarily by a requirement that militaries see to hold at risk and target the other side's military. Because I think both in the United States and to a lesser extent in Russia, there's a certain degree of discomfort with minimal deterrence. Because the idea then is, how do you turn to the other guy? Well, you hold at risk their cities. And American presidents are profoundly uncomfortable with the idea that my only nuclear option is to launch nuclear weapons at an opponent's cities. So the militaries have tended to develop options for targeting military forces, and that tends to drive the level of weapons way up. I think part of the problem also is we're still suffering something of a Cold War overhang. The United States has formally declared, and I've heard the commander of Strategic Command say, we do not regard the Russians as an enemy or an opponent. We're past the Cold War. And I think that's, for the most part, that's true. I mean, we have problems with Russia, but it's not like the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But now, having said that, you know, I once asked the commander of Strategic Command, okay, why do you need 1,550 warheads then? And I don't think they had a good answer to that question. So part of this, I think, is just trying to move beyond the Cold War. They've made lots of progress, coming down from 8,000 or 10,000 weapons to 1,550. I hope they can do more.
Well, you also made a good argument for not bothering with renewing bombers if they take 8 hours to get there. But I think you also opened a window to talk about the submarines, because do we really need to spend that much money on those submarines if we have a land-based defense?
Yeah. On the submarine question, and primarily this is due to geography and the fact that the U.S. has easy access to oceans, but submarines, our ballistic missile submarines, are considered to be very effective and very survivable. As far as I know, there is no unclassified report of another country ever having successfully tracked an American ballistic missile submarine. And what that means is those submarines are safe at sea, and if they ever had to retaliate, we can be pretty confident they would survive. One of the problems that you have with bombers, of course, is that there's a chance that bombers are vulnerable at their bases. They would have to cope with air defenses. And with land-based missiles, I mean, the Russians know where our ICBMs are. We know where their ICBMs are, and they could be targeted. So I think U.S., going back to the 1960s, the United States has placed greatest reliance among the three elements of the triad, land-based missiles, bombers, and missiles on submarines. The U.S. has tended to put the bulk of its weapons on the submarines. And I suspect that's going to continue. But my argument is, you know, maybe we don't need to build 12 submarines, which is the current plan. Maybe 8 or 9 submarines might make sense and might be cheaper. The bomber question is one where I find it interesting. I think the Air Force, they're talking about a new bomber now. I think the cost is estimated at $550 million each. And that's where, I mean, if you go back to, let's see, at this top picture, the B-52. The B-52s in the American force have been flying for 50 years. The plan is they'll fly for another 25 years because they're actually very solid aircraft. They can take a heavy load of bombs a long distance. The problem is they're a really big target on a radar screen. And so the Air Force would like to have a new bomber that would have a better chance to survive where there are more sophisticated air defenses. And I think the Air Force actually doesn't want this so much for nuclear weapons, but more for conventional weapons. But again, there's a question that in the current fiscal environment, are we going to be able to afford that? And my own thought would be is that if you're looking at the bomber leg of the triad, there may be conventional reasons to build a new bomber, but I'm less persuaded that it makes sense to have a nuclear role for these aircraft.
Next.
The question really is that no way are they coming to catch up to us. I understand that. But by building up their capability, does that weaken our promise to support Japan and with our nuclear umbrella? Mm-hmm. And therefore, as they're now getting into these conflicts over the South China Sea, does the nuclear issue become more relevant?
Sure. Now, that's a really good question. China has, it's now estimated between 250 and 300 nuclear weapons, of which the estimate is about 50 of them to 60 of those weapons could actually reach the United States. And I mentioned earlier this idea of a minimal nuclear deterrent. I think the Chinese do base their nuclear program on a minimal deterrent. I think the calculation of the Chinese leadership is that if they can hold at risk, say, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Denver, and Los Angeles, that will likely deter an American president from most things they would want to deter him from doing. And I think they're probably right in that calculation. An American commander who walks into the Oval Office and says, "Sir, I've got this great plan for dealing with China, and you only have to risk losing Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Denver," is likely to be invited to go back and come up with another plan. And the Chinese have actually, while they have increased the capabilities, appear to be not building up the numbers, which I think is a good thing. Now, you have a very good question there about, does a growing Chinese nuclear capability affect what's called the extended deterrent? Is that American nuclear weapons exist not only to deter an attack on the United States, but also to deter attack on our NATO allies and in the Asia-Pacific area on Japan, South Korea, and Australia? And extended deterrence, it's a hard concept, because I think the Chinese understand that if they attack the United States with nuclear weapons, there'll be a nuclear response. Deterrence works. But would the Chinese believe that if they were to attack Japan, would the Americans respond with nuclear weapons when China could then go after Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and Denver? And that's where it gets a little bit more difficult. And so a lot of the effort in the last really 50 years on deterrence has said, how can you basically assure allies that the U.S. nuclear umbrella, that the U.S. is prepared to be supportive? And I think in the case of China, we probably have, I think, the force structure that can assure the Japanese and the South Koreans. The one question I guess I would put down a mark on would be missile defense. And that is, the United States has developed a capability to defend the United States against limited ballistic missile attack. That's been the policy for 20 years. So there are now about 30 missile interceptors in Alaska and California, which provide a measure of protection if North Korea or, say, Iran ever got an intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, these defenses are not all that good at this point. Their success ratio in tests is well under 50%. And I once asked somebody who's judged my trust, I said, what would happen if you saw a North Korean missile headed for the United States? What would you do? And he said, I would fire a whole bunch of these interceptors and cross my fingers. The worrisome thing about this is American policy is, the stated policy is to defend the United States against a limited ballistic missile attack. On the other side, we've also said we have no intention of trying to defend the United States against a Russian attack because there are so many Russian missile warheads and we only have 30 interceptors. What's interesting is we're ambiguous about China. And I once asked somebody, and they said, well, it's a couple reasons. One is we're not sure that it would be politically comfortable for Americans to understand that you're not only vulnerable to Russia, but you're also vulnerable to China. And the concern is, if the Japanese felt that we were vulnerable to China, would the Japanese worry that if it came to it, would our extended deterrent apply? And this may be one question where we ought to think a little bit about our missile defense program, because the one thing I think that might lead the Chinese to build up their numbers is if they begin to worry that our missile defenses could shoot down a lot of their missiles, then one of their options is to build more missiles to overcome our numbers. And having that kind of offense-defense race with China would not be in our interest. It would be very expensive, and I don't think it would add to our security.
Okay, sir.
Does Edward Snowden's cache of data have any impact here? In other words, can we be exposed to things that could create great problems going forward?
I don't know. I mean, what I worry about is that what he may have compromised is some of the intelligence systems that we use to gather information that may be related to nuclear weapons questions. Because one of the things that the intelligence community depends on, it's not just what the Russians tell us, but we have spy satellites. You know, we use other intelligence means to try to make sure that the information that we have about Russian strategic forces is as accurate as possible. Snowden's a complicated case. Part of me says, you know, what he exposed was something that we needed to know. I mean, I think that there certainly were excesses by the National Security Agency. Part of me also says, though, that he betrayed his country. He betrayed his oath. I mean, there are certain things he said, I think, about a week after he had landed in Russia. He disclosed, cited back to him, that the National Security Agency and their British counterparts had bugged or tried to bug Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in an international conference in London in 2009. That, to my mind, is not exposing excesses of the NSA against Americans. I mean, if you don't have the NSA to bug the Russian president, what do you have them for? So I think some of the things that he's done have been usually damaging. What I don't know is whether there's been damage done in terms of our ability to track some of the developments with regards to Russian strategic forces.
Over here.
How do you feel about Iran in terms of, if negotiations got nowhere, would you be in favor of bombing their facilities?
Well, first of all, I'm more optimistic about the negotiating path of Iran than I have been in the last 5 years, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we can find a negotiated solution. If it came down to that, if we became persuaded that Iran was getting a nuclear weapon, I would personally not favor an attack on Iran. I would argue instead for a containment strategy. And here are my reasons. One is when you, well, Secretary Gates 3 years ago said, what would an American military attack do on Iran? He said, it will not end the program. It will delay it by a couple of years. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we prepared as a country to go back and bomb Iran every 2 or 3 years? The second question I would ask is, what are the costs of that action? First of all, right now, it's not totally clear. I mean, the U.S. intelligence community says Iran has not yet made a decision to acquire a nuclear weapon. What they have done is made a decision to get the pieces together so that if they were to take that political decision, they could then acquire a nuclear weapon fairly quickly. If we bomb them, they've made the decision. They're going to get a nuclear weapon. Third point is, right now I think there's some division in Iranian society, and I think there's some pushback against the hardline elements. If American bombs fall on Iran, we're going to unite that society in a very negative way for our perspective. Fourth reason why I do this is, right now, under the terms of Iran's agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, there are monitoring devices and regular inspections of all of Iran's nuclear activities. So we know to the kilogram how much low-enriched uranium they produced. We know how many centrifuges they have. We know the locations. This is all monitored. As soon as American bombs start falling, all of that gets turned off, and we lose all of our insights into what their program is doing. And then you start asking questions. I mean, Iran is not going to just sit back. Most things I've heard, you know, it's not a one-night air campaign. It's going to last for some time. Iran's not going to sit back and say, okay, we'll take that, we lost. They'll find ways to retaliate. You know, they may not be able to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, but they're fully capable of knocking out some tankers. So, you know, we better get prepared to think of things like $6 and $8 per gallon for gas. What do they do in terms of mischief-making in Afghanistan, Iraq? Do they try to launch terrorism attacks into the United States? I think before anybody talks about military action, you have to ask what happens next. And what happens next, I think, from an American point of view, can be very, very ugly. Now, deterrence and containment of Iran is not an optimal solution, but I would argue it may be better than a military action. And that is, I think we can deploy the forces in the area. We can make very clear to the Iranians that any use of an Iranian nuclear weapon would invite American retaliation. And that's not a good outcome. But again, I fear that the costs of actually military conflict in Iran, and one of my colleagues said, you know, the only way that you could be absolutely certain that you had ended the Iranian nuclear program would be a land invasion. I don't think that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the United States, you know, for another war like that in that part of the world anytime soon.
There are some voices in Europe, including the one of the former Secretary of Defense of Germany, Volker Rühe, who were going so far as to including Russia into NATO.
Yes.
What do you think, how realistic is that, and what are the possible obstacles to that?
That question actually came up when I was working at the White House in 1995. And you know, President Clinton asked, okay, if Yeltsin comes to me and says, I want Russia to join NATO, what should our answer be? And we came back with an answer. We said, the answer should be, if Russia's prepared to meet the requirements of NATO, which are not just military requirements, but there were also requirements regarding democracy and economic reform. In fact, countries that wanted to come into NATO, you know, they got pushed much harder in terms of establishing the democratic credentials and the economic reforms as they did on the military reforms. But the position signed off by the president was, if Russia's prepared to make a contribution to North Atlantic security, and if Russia can meet the same requirements that we're asking everybody else, there's no reason why NATO should say no. Now, by the mid-1990s, the Russians basically said, you know, we're not interested in NATO membership. And that was one of the reasons, getting back to your question over here, that led us to think, if we could promote a special relationship between NATO and Russia, you know, that might be the way to bring the Russians into a more cooperative mode. But as I said, we underestimated just how hard overcoming the Russian antipathy towards NATO enlargement would be.
Go ahead.
You seem to be very optimistic about the fact that after an arms reduction treaty, the inspection teams can count the number of surviving weapons.
Yeah.
Having lived involuntarily in Siberia for 6 years in Russia, I have great doubt about the integrity of the Russians. Is your optimism justified?
Yeah. Excellent question, because you know, on these treaties, we're not operating on the basis of trust. There are some very stringent verification measures put into these. In terms of what we have to monitor and verify under New START, I'm very confident, because under New START, remember, we're only counting deployed warheads, that is, warheads that sit on ballistic missiles. If there may be lots of warheads out in Siberia that are separate from those, but we don't worry about those so much because, A, they're not on their delivery systems, so they can't be used in a matter of minutes. They might take hours or days or even weeks to prepare. But with regards to deployed warheads, I'm actually very confident. And I'll give you an example of how something works. Let's say it's a Russian inspection team coming to the United States. And that team lands, their entry point for the eastern United States is Dulles Airport. They arrive at Dulles Airport. They declare it's a Type 1 inspection, which is Type 1, Type 2, they're different types of inspections. And then they say, we want to go to Kings Bay, Georgia. And there are very strict timelines. They have to be on their way to Kings Bay, Georgia within a couple of hours. As soon as they say Kings Bay, Georgia, all of a sudden things start happening at Kings Bay. Submarines can't leave. Submarines can't come into port. Large vehicles that could carry a missile have to stop moving. The inspection team, when it arrives there, is then going to be given a list and say, here's every submarine in port. And the list will say, for this submarine here, the USS Georgia, missile tube number one has a deployed missile. It has 3 warheads. Missile tube number 2 has a deployed warhead. It has 7 warheads. Missile tube number 3 has a deployed missile. It has 4 warheads. They get that for all the information. And then the Russian team is then allowed to say, okay, we want to go on board the Georgia and take a look at the number of warheads on missile tube number 6. You said 2 warheads. Open it up and we get to look. So there's a pretty defined system now that creates, you know, they don't get to look at more than one. But when the U.S. and the Russian militaries thought about this, they said, if you have 10 of these inspections a year, that creates a fairly big chance that if we cheat, you're going to discover it. The flip side of it was the militaries actually hate the inspections because if all of a sudden you're that commander at Kings Bay, Georgia, and you're told submarines can't go, submarines can't, you know, come in, it really messes up your day-to-day operations. So they find that balance between what you need for verification on the one hand and what you need to reduce the impact on day-to-day operations. But in terms of monitoring that limit and our ability to count warheads on missiles, the intelligence community testified to the Senate that they have high confidence in our ability to check that. If we begin to go beyond warheads on missiles and start talking about reserve weapons or tactical weapons in storage bunkers like that picture I showed, I think then the question gets much, much harder. And our ability to have confidence in our ability to monitor those weapons numbers is going to be a lot harder to sustain.
Okay, last question over here.
You've made very clear that we've been pretty lucky so far not to have an accidental nuclear war. And the book that's current now, Command and Control, gives other examples mm-hmm. of how we've just barely gotten by through some...
It's a very scary book.
Divine intervention and not had an accident. If we did have an accident, and there's always that possibility, and a nuclear war did start, say by accident, how could you end it?
No, I mean, I think that's one of the real, that's the biggest argument for not getting into a nuclear war to begin with. Because some of these things can move so fast, their effects are so devastating, it's very, very hard to see how you could control it. And I think that, you know, the U.S. military, there are plans. Could you terminate things? Could you avoid certain targets and things like that? But my fear is that once you've crossed the nuclear threshold, once you've used that first nuclear weapon, lots of other nuclear weapons get used, and it could be very, very hard to stop things before the devastation was beyond the imaginable. So again, my argument is you don't want to have that first one go off. You want to be able to avoid it as opposed to try to deal with the consequences.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.